Chapter 13. The Unbreakable Alibi. Tommy and Tuppence were busy sorting correspondence. Tuppence gave an exclamation and handed a letter across to Tommy.
A new client, she said importantly.
Ha! Said Tommy. What do we deduce from this letter, Watson?
Nothing much, except the somewhat obvious fact that Mr. Montgomery Jones is not one of the world's best spellers, thereby proving that he has been expensively educated.
Montgomery Jones, said Tuppence. Now what do I know about a Montgomery Jones?
Oh yes, I've got it now. I think Janet St. Vincent mentioned him. His mother was Lady Aileen Montgomery, very crusty in high church, with gold crosses and things, and she married a man called Jones, who was immensely rich.
In fact, the same old story, said Tommy.
Let me see. What time does this Mr. M.J. wish to see us?
Ah, 11:30.
At 11:30 precisely, a very tall young man with an amiable and ingenuous countenance entered the outer office and addressed himself to Albert, the office boy.
Look here. I say, can I, see Mr. Blunt?
Have you an appointment, sir? Said Albert.
Well, I don't quite know. Yes, I suppose I have. What I mean is, I wrote a letter.
What name, sir?
Mr. Montgomery Jones.
I will take your name in to Mr. Blunt. He returned after a brief interval.
Will you wait a few minutes, please, sir? Mr. Blunt is engaged on a very important conference at present.
Oh, yes, certainly, said Mr. Montgomery Jones.
Having, he hoped, impressed his client sufficiently, Tommy rang the buzzer on his desk, and Mr. Montgomery Jones was ushered into the inner office by Albert. Tommy rose to greet him, and shaking him warmly by the hand, motioned towards the vacant chair.
Now, Mr. Montgomery Jones, he said briskly, what can we have the pleasure of doing for you?
Mr. Montgomery Jones looked uncertainly at the third occupant of the office.
My confidential secretary, Miss Robinson, said Tommy. You can speak quite freely before her. I take it that this is some family matter of a delicate kind.
Well, not exactly, said Mr. Montgomery Jones.
You surprise me, said Tommy.
You're not in trouble of any kind yourself, I hope.
Oh, rather not, said Mr. Montgomery Jones.
Well, said Tommy, perhaps you will, state the facts plainly.
That, however, seemed to be the one thing that Mr. Montgomery Jones could not do.
It's a dashed odd sort of thing I've got to ask you, he said hesitatingly. I really don't know how to set about it.
We never touch divorce cases, said Tommy.
Oh, Lord, no, said Mr. Montgomery Jones. I don't mean that. It's a deuced silly sort of a joke, that's all.
Someone has played a practical joke on you of a mysterious nature, suggested Tommy. But Mr. Montgomery Jones once more shook his head.
Well, said Tommy, retiring gracefully from the position, take your own time and let us have it in your own words.
There was a pause.
You see, said Mr. Jones at last, it was at dinner. I sat next to a girl.
Yes, said Tommy encouragingly.
She was a... Oh, well, I really can't describe her, but she was simply one of the most sporting girls I've ever met. She's an Australian, over here with another girl, sharing a flat with her in Clarges Street. She's simply game for anything. I absolutely can't tell you the effect that girl had on me.
We can quite imagine it, Mr. Jones, said Tuppence. She saw clearly that if Mr. Montgomery Jones's troubles were ever to be extracted, a sympathetic feminine touch was needed, as distinct from the business-like methods of Mr. Blunt.
We can understand, said Tuppence, encouragingly.
Well, the whole thing came as an absolute shock to me, said Mr. Montgomery Jones, that a girl could, well, knock you over like that. There'd been another girl, in fact, well, two other girls. One was awfully jolly and all that, but I didn't much like her chin. She danced marvellously, though. I have known her all my life, which makes a fellow feel kind of safe, you know. And then there was one of those girls at the Frivolity. Frightfully amusing, but of course there'd be a lot of ructions with the matter over that, and anyway, I didn't really want to marry either of them. But I was thinking about things, you know, and then, slap out of the blue, I sat next to this girl and...
The whole world was changed, said Tuppence in a feeling voice. Tommy moved impatiently in his chair. He was by now somewhat bored by the recital of Mr. Montgomery Jones's love affairs.
You put it awfully well, said Mr. Montgomery Jones. That is absolutely what it was like. Only, you know, I fancy she didn't think much of me. You mayn't think it, but I'm not terribly clever.
Oh, you mustn't be too modest, said Tuppence.
Oh, I do realize that I'm not much of a chap, said Mr. Jones with an engaging smile. Not for a perfectly marvellous girl like that. That's why I just feel I've got to put this thing through. It's my only chance. She's such a sporting girl that she would never go back on her word.
Well, I'm sure we wish you luck and all that, said Tuppence kindly, but I don't exactly see what you want us to do.
Oh, Lord, said Mr. Montgomery Jones, haven't I explained?
No, said Tommy, you haven't.
Well, it was like this. We were talking about detective stories. Una, that's her name, is just as keen about them as I am. We got talking about one in particular. It all hinges on an alibi. Then we got talking about alibis and faking them. Then I said, no, she said, now, which of us was it that said it?
Never mind which of you it was, said Tuppence.
I said it would be a jolly difficult thing to do. She disagreed, said it only wanted a bit of brain work. We got all hot and excited about it, and in the end she said, I'll make you a sporting offer. What do you bet that I can produce an alibi that nobody can shake? Well, anything you like, I said. And we settled it then and there. She was frightfully cocksure about the whole thing. It's an odds-on chance for me, she said. Don't be so sure of that, I said. Supposing you lose, and I ask you for anything I like. She laughed and said she came of a gambling family and I could.
Well, said Tuppence, as Mr. Jones came to a pause and looked at her appealingly.
Well, don't you see? It's up to me. It's the only chance I've got of getting a girl like that to look at me. You have no idea how sporting she is. Last summer, she was out in a boat, and someone bet her she wouldn't jump overboard and swim ashore in her clothes, and she did it.
It's a very curious proposition, said Tommy. I'm not quite sure I yet understand it.
It's perfectly simple, said Mr. Montgomery Jones. You must be doing this sort of thing all the time, investigating fake alibis, and seeing where they fall down.
Oh, yes, of course, said Tommy. We do a lot of that sort of work.
Someone has got to do it for me, said Montgomery Jones. I shouldn't be any good at that sort of thing myself. You've only got to catch her out, and everything's all right. I dare say it seems rather a futile business to you, but it means a lot to me, and I'm prepared to pay, all necessary whatnots, you know.
Well, that will be all right, said Tuppence. I'm sure Mr. Blunt will take this case on for you.
Oh, certainly, certainly, said Tommy. A most refreshing case, most refreshing indeed.
Mr. Montgomery Jones heaved a sigh of relief, pulled a mass of papers from his pocket, and selected one of them.
Here it is, he said. She says, I'm sending you proof I was in two distinct places at one and the same time. According to one story, I dined at the Bon Ton restaurant in Soho by myself, went to the Duke's Theatre, and had supper with a friend, Mr. Le Marchant, at the Savoy. But I was also staying at the Castle Hotel Torquay and only returned to London on the following morning. You've got to find out which of the two stories is the true one and how I managed the other.
There, said Mr. Montgomery Jones.
Now, you see what it is I want you to do.
A most refreshing little problem, said Tommy. Very naive.
Here is Una's photograph, said Mr. Montgomery Jones. You will want that.
What is the lady's full name? Inquired Tommy.
Miss Una Drake, and her address is 180 Clarges Street.
Thank you, said Tommy.
Well, we will look into the matter for you, Mr. Montgomery Jones. I hope we shall have good news for you very shortly.
I say, you know, I'm no end grateful, said Mr. Jones, rising to his feet and shaking Tommy by the hand. It has taken an awful load off my mind.
Having seen his client out, Tommy returned to the inner office. Tuppence was at the cupboard that contained the classic library.
"Inspector French," said Tuppence.
"Eh?" said Tommy.
"Inspector French, of course," said Tuppence. "He always does alibis. I know the exact procedure. We have to go over everything and check it. At first it will seem all right, and then when we examine it more closely, we shall find the flaw."
"Well, there ought not to be much difficulty about that," agreed Tommy. "I mean, knowing that one of them is a fake to start with makes the thing almost a certainty, I should say. That is what worries me."
"I don't see anything to worry about in that."
"I'm worrying about the girl," said Tommy. "She will probably be let in to marry that young man, whether she wants to or not."
"Darling," said Tuppence, "don't be so foolish. Women are never the wild gamblers they appear. Unless that girl was already perfectly prepared to marry that pleasant but rather empty-headed young man, she would never have let herself in for a wager of this kind. But, Tommy, believe me, she will marry him with more enthusiasm and respect if he wins the wager than if she has to make it easy for him in some other way."
"You do think you know about everything," said her husband.
"I do," said Tuppence.
"And now, to examine our data," said Tommy, drawing the papers towards him. "First, the photograph."
Quite a nice-looking girl. And quite a good photograph, I should say. Clear and easily recognizable."
"We must get some other girls' photographs," said Tuppence.
"Why?"
"They always do," said Tuppence.
"You show 4 or 5 to waiters and they pick out the right one."
"You think they do?" said Tommy.
"Pick out the right one, I mean?"
"Well, they do in books," said Tuppence.
"It's a pity that real life is so different from fiction," said Tommy.
"Now, what have we here?"
"Yes, this is the London lot. Dined at the Bon Ton, 7:30. Went to Duke's Theatre and saw Delphinium's Blue. Counterfoil of theatre ticket enclosed. Supper at the Savoy with Mr. Le Marchant." "We can, I suppose, interview Mr. Le Marchant."
"But that tells us nothing at all," said Tuppence.
"Because if he is helping her to do it, he naturally won't give the show away. We can wash out anything he says now."
"Well, here is the Torquay end," went on Tommy. 12 o'clock from Paddington. At lunch in the restaurant car, receipted bill enclosed. Stayed at Castle Hotel for one night. Again, receipted bill."
"I think this is all rather weak," said Tuppence. "Anyone can buy a theatre ticket. You never need go near the theatre."
"The girl just went to Torquay, and the London thing is a fake.
If so, it's rather a sitter for us," said Tommy.
"Well, I suppose we might as well go and interview Mr. Le Marchant."
Mr. Le Marchant proved to be a breezy youth who betrayed no great surprise on seeing them.
"Una's got some little game on, hasn't she?" he asked. "You never know what that kid is up to."
"I understand, Mr. Le Marchant," said Tommy, "that Miss Drake had supper with you at the Savoy last Tuesday evening."
"That's right," said Mr. Le Marchant.
"I know it was Tuesday because Una impressed it on me at the time, and what's more, she made me write it down in a little book." With some pride, he showed an entry faintly pencilled. "Having supper with Una, Savoy, Tuesday 19th.
Where had Miss Drake been earlier in the evening, do you know?"
"Oh, she'd been to some rotten show called Pink Peonies or something like that. Absolute slosh, so she told me."
"You are quite sure Miss Drake was with you that evening?"
Mr. Le Marchant stared at him.
"Why, of course. Haven't I been telling you?"
"Perhaps she asked you to tell us," said Tuppence.
"Well, for a matter of fact, she did say something that was rather dashed odd. She said, what was it now? 'You think you're sitting here having supper with me, Jimmy, but really, I'm having supper 200 miles away in Devonshire.' Now, that was a dashed odd thing to say, don't you think so? Sort of astral body stuff. The funny thing is that a pal of mine, Dickie Rice, thought he saw her there."
"Who is this Mr. Rice?"
"Oh, just a friend of mine. He'd been down in Torquay, staying with an aunt. Sort of old bean who's always going to die and never does. Dickie had been down doing the dutiful nephew. He said, 'I saw that Australian girl one day. Una, something or other. Wanted to go and talk to her, but my aunt carried me off to chat with an old pussy in a bath chair. I said, when was this? And he said, oh, Tuesday, about tea time.' I told him, of course, that he'd made a mistake. But it was odd, wasn't it? With Una saying that about Devonshire that evening."
"Very odd," said Tommy.
"Tell me, Mr. Le Marchant, did anyone you know
have supper near you at the Savoy? Some people called Ogland over at the next table. Do they know Miss Drake? Oh, yes, they know her. They're not frightful friends or anything of that kind. Well, if there's nothing more you can tell us, Mr. Lamarchant, I think we will wish you good morning. Either that chap is an extraordinarily good liar, said Tommy as they reached the street, or else he is speaking the truth. Yes, said Tuppence. I've changed my opinion. I have a sort of feeling now that Una Drake was at the Savoy for supper that night. We will now go to the Bon Ton, said Tommy. A little food for starving sleuths is clearly indicated. Let's just get a few girls' photographs first. This proved rather more difficult than was expected. Turning into a photographer's and demanding a few assorted photographs, they were met with a cold rebuff. Why are all these things that are so easy and simple in books so difficult in real life? Wailed Tuppence. How horribly suspicious they looked. What do you think they thought we wanted to do with the photographs? We'd better go and raid Jane's flat. Tuppence's friend Jane proved of an accommodating disposition and permitted Tuppence to rummage in a drawer and select four specimens of former friends of Jane's who had been shoved hastily in to be out of sight and mind. Armed with this galaxy of feminine beauty, they proceeded to the Bon Ton, where fresh difficulties and much expense awaited them. Tommy had to get hold of each waiter in turn, tip him, then produce the assorted photographs. The result was unsatisfactory. At least three of the photographs were promising starters as having dined there last Tuesday. They then returned to the office, where Tuppence immersed herself in an ABC. Paddington, 12 o'clock. Torquay, 3:35. That's the train. And Lamarchant's friend, Mr. Sago or Tapioca or something, saw her there about tea time. We haven't checked his statement, remember, said Tommy. If, as you said to begin with, Lamarchant is a friend of Una Drake's, he may have invented this story. Oh, we'll hunt up Mr. Rice, said Tuppence. I have a kind of hunch that Mr. Lamarchant was speaking the truth. No, what I'm trying to get at now is this. Una Drake leaves London by the 12 o'clock train, possibly takes a room at a hotel and unpacks. Then she takes a train back to town, arriving in time to get to the Savoy. There is one at 4:30, gets up to Paddington at 9:10. And then, said Tommy. And then, said Tuppence, frowning, it is rather more difficult. There is a midnight train from Paddington down again, but you could hardly take that. That would be too early. A fast car, suggested Tommy. Said Tuppence. It is just on 200 miles. Australians, I've always been told, drive very recklessly. Oh, I suppose it could be done, said Tuppence. She would arrive there about 7. Are you supposing her to have nipped into her bed at the Castle Hotel without being seen, or arriving there explaining that she'd been out all night, and could she have her bill, please? Tommy, said Tuppence, we're idiots. She needn't have gone back to Torquay at all. She's only got to get a friend to go to the hotel there and collect her luggage and pay her bill. Then you get the receipted bill with the proper date on it. I think on the whole we have worked out a very sound hypothesis, said Tommy. The next thing to do is catch the 12 o'clock train to Torquay tomorrow and verify our brilliant conclusions. Armed with a portfolio of photographs, Tommy and Tuppence duly established themselves in a first-class carriage the following morning and booked seats for the second lunch. It probably won't be the same dining car attendance, said Tommy. That would be too much luck to expect. I expect we shall have to travel up and down to Torquay for days before we strike the right ones. This alibi business is very trying, said Tuppence. In books it is all passed over in 2 or 3 paragraphs. Inspector something then boarded the train to Torquay and questioned the dining car attendants, and so ended the story. For once, however, the young couple's luck was in. In answer to their question, the attendant who brought their bill for lunch proved to be the same one who had been on duty the preceding Tuesday. What Tommy called the 10-shilling touch then came into action, and Tuppence produced the portfolio. I want to know, said Tommy, if any of these ladies had lunch on this train on Tuesday last. In a gratifying manner worthy of the best detective fiction, the man at once indicated the photograph of Una Drake. Yes, sir. I remember that lady, and I remember that it was Tuesday, because the lady herself drew attention to the fact, saying it was always the luckiest day in the week for her. So far so good, said Tuppence, as they returned to their compartment. And we will probably find that she booked at the hotel all right. It is going to be more difficult to prove that she travelled back to London, but perhaps one of the porters at the station may remember. Here, however, they drew a blank, and crossing to the up platform, Tommy made inquiries of the ticket collector and of various porters. After the distribution of half-crowns as a preliminary to inquiring, two of the porters picked out one of the other photographs with a vague remembrance that someone like that travelled to town by the 4:40 that afternoon, but there was no identification of Una Drake. "But that doesn't prove anything," said Tuppence, as they left the station. "She may have travelled by that train and no one noticed her. Or she may have gone from the other station, from Tor." "Well, that's quite likely," said Tuppence. "However, we can see to that after we've been to the hotel." The Castle Hotel was a big one overlooking the sea. After booking a room for the night and signing the register, Tommy observed pleasantly, "I believe you had a friend of ours staying here last Tuesday, Miss Una Drake." The young lady in the bureau beamed at him. "Oh, yes. I remember quite well. An Australian young lady, I believe." At a sign from Tommy, Tuppence produced the photograph. "That's a rather charming photograph of her, isn't it?" said Tuppence. "Oh, very nice. Very nice indeed. Quite stylish."
"Did she stay here long?" inquired Tommy.
"Only the one night. She went away by the express the next morning back to London. It seemed a long way to come for one night. But of course, I suppose Australian ladies don't think anything of travelling."
"She's a very sporting girl," said Tommy, "always having adventures. It wasn't here, was it, that she went out to dine with some friends, went for a drive in their car afterwards, ran the car into a ditch and wasn't able to get home till morning?"
"Oh, no," said the young lady. "Miss Drake had dinner here, in the hotel."
"Really?" said Tommy. "Are you sure of that? I mean, how do you know?"
"Oh, I saw her.
I asked because I understood she was dining with some friends in Torquay," explained Tommy.
"Oh, no, sir. She dined here."
The young lady laughed and blushed a little.
"I remember she had on a most sweetly pretty frock, one of those new flowered chiffons all over pansies."
"Tuppence, this tears it," said Tommy, when they had been shown upstairs to their room.
"It does, rather," said Tuppence. "Of course, that woman may be mistaken. We will ask the waiter at dinner. There can't be very many people here just at this time of year."
This time it was Tuppence who opened the attack.
"Can you tell me if a friend of mine was here last Tuesday?" she asked the waiter with an engaging smile. "A Miss Drake, wearing a frock all over pansies, I believe."
She produced a photograph.
"This lady."
The waiter broke into immediate smiles of recognition.
"Yes, yes, Miss Drake, I remember her very well. She told me she came from Australia."
"She dined here?"
"Yes, it was last Tuesday. She asked me if there was anything to do afterwards in the town."
"Yes?"
"I told her the theatre, the pavilion, but in the end she decided not to go, and she stayed here listening to our orchestra."
"Oh, damn," said Tommy under his breath. "You don't remember what time she had dinner, do you?" asked Tuppence.
"Well, she came down a little late. It must have been about 8 o'clock.
"Damn, blast and curse," said Tuppence, as she and Tommy left the dining room. "Tommy, this is all going wrong. It seems so clear and lovely."
"Well, I suppose we ought to have known it wouldn't all be plain sailing."
"Is there any train she could have taken after that, I wonder?"
"Not one that would have landed her in London in time to go to the Savoy."
"Well," said Tuppence, "as a last hope, I'm going to talk to the chambermaid. Una Drake had a room on the same floor as ours."
The chambermaid was a voluble and informative woman. Yes, she remembered the young lady quite well. That was her picture right enough. A very nice young lady, very merry and talkative. Had told her a lot about Australia and the kangaroos. The young lady rang the bell about 9:30 and asked for her bottle to be filled and put in her bed, and also to be called the next morning at 7:30 with coffee instead of tea.
"You did call her? And she was in her bed?" asked Tuppence.
"Why, yes, ma'am, of course."
"Oh, I only wondered if she was doing exercises or anything," said Tuppence wildly. "So many people do in the early morning."
"Well, that seems cast iron enough," said Tommy, when the chambermaid had departed. "There is only one conclusion to be drawn from it. It is the London side of the thing that must be faked."
"Mr. Le Marchant must be a more accomplished liar than we thought," said Tuppence.
"We have a way of checking his statements," said Tommy. "He said there were people sitting at the next table whom Una knew slightly."
"What was their name?"
"Oglander, that was it.
We must hunt up these Oglanders, and we ought also to make inquiries at Miss Drake's flat in Clarges Street. The following morning, they paid their bill and departed somewhat crestfallen. Hunting out the Oglanders was fairly easy with the aid of the telephone book. Tuppence this time took the offensive and assumed the character of a representative of a new illustrated paper. She called on Mrs. Oglander, asking for a few details of their smart supper party at the Savoy on Tuesday evening. These details Mrs. Oglander was only too willing to supply. Just as she was leaving, Tuppence added carelessly, "Now let me see, wasn't Miss Drake sitting at the table next to you? Is it really true that she is engaged to the Duke of Perth? You know her, of course."
"I know her slightly," said Mrs. Oglander. "A very charming girl, I believe. Yes, she was sitting at the next table to ours with Mr. Le Marchant. My girls know her better than I do."
Tuppence's next port of call was the flat in Clarges Street. Here she was greeted by Miss Marjorie Lester, the friend with whom Miss Drake shared a flat.
"Oh, do tell me what this is all about," asked Miss Lester plaintively. "Una has some deep game on, and I don't know what it is. Of course she slept here on Tuesday night."
"Did you see her when she came in?"
"No, I had gone to bed. She's got her own latchkey, of course. She came in about 1 o'clock, I believe."
"When did you see her?"
"Oh, the next morning, about 9. Or perhaps it was nearer 10.
As Tuppence left the flat, she almost collided with a tall, gaunt female who was entering.
"Excuse me, miss, I'm sure," said the gaunt female.
"Do you work here?" asked Tuppence.
"Yes, miss, I come daily."
"What time do you get here in the morning?"
9 o'clock is my time, miss."
Tuppence slipped a hurried half-crown into the gaunt female's hand. "Was Miss Drake here last Tuesday morning when you arrived?"
"Why, yes, miss, indeed she was, fast asleep in her bed, and hardly woke up when I brought in her tea."
"Oh, thank you," said Tuppence, and went disconsolately down the stairs. She had arranged to meet Tommy for lunch in a small restaurant in Soho, and there they compared notes. "I've seen that fellow Rice. It's quite true. He did see Una Drake in the distance at Torquay."
"Well," said Tuppence, "we've checked these alibis, all right.
Here, give me a bit of paper and a pencil, Tommy. Let us put it down neatly, like all detectives do. 1:30, Una Drake seen in luncheon car of train. 4 o'clock, arrives at Castle Hotel. 5 o'clock, seen by Mr. Rice. 8 o'clock, seen dining at hotel. 9:30, asks for hot water bottle. 11:30, seen at Savoy with Mr. Le Marchant. 7:30 a.m., called by chambermaid at Castle Hotel. 9 o'clock, called by charwoman at flat at Clarges Street." They looked at each other.
"Well, it looks to me as if Blunt's brilliant detectives are beat," said Tommy.
"Oh, we mustn't give up," said Tuppence. "Somebody must be lying."
"But the queer thing is that it strikes me nobody was lying. They all seemed perfectly truthful and straightforward."
"Yet there must be a flaw. We know there is. I think of all sorts of things like private aeroplanes, but that doesn't really get us any forwarder."
"I'm inclined to the theory of an astral body."
"Well," said Tuppence,
"the only thing to do is to sleep on it. Your subconscious works in your sleep."
Said Tommy.
"If your subconscious provides you with a perfectly good answer to this riddle by tomorrow morning, I take my hat off to it."
They were very silent all that evening. Again and again, Tuppence reverted to the paper of times. She wrote things on bits of paper. She murmured to herself. She sought perplexedly through rail guides. But in the end, they both rose to go to bed with no faint glimmer of light on the problem.
"This is very disheartening," said Tommy. "One of the most miserable evenings I've ever spent," said Tuppence.
"We ought to have gone to a music hall," said Tommy. "A few good jokes about mothers-in-law and twins and bottles of beer would have done us no end of good."
"No, you will see, this concentration will work in the end," said Tuppence.
"How busy our subconscious will have to be in the next 8 hours."
And on this hopeful note, they went to bed.
"Well," said Tommy the next morning, "has the subconscious worked?"
"I have got an idea," said Tuppence.
"You have? What sort of an idea?"
"Well, rather a funny idea, not at all like anything I've ever read in detective stories. As a matter of fact,
It's an idea that you put into my head.
Well, then it must be a good idea, said Tommy firmly. Come on, Tuppence, out with it.
I shall have to send a cable to verify it, said Tuppence.
No,
I'm not going to tell you. It's a perfectly wild idea, but it's the only thing that fits the facts.
Well, said Tommy, I must away to the office. A room full of disappointed clients must not wait in vain. I leave this case in the hands of my promising subordinate.
Tuppence nodded cheerfully. She did not put in an appearance at the office all day. When Tommy returned that evening, about 5:30, it was to find a wildly exultant Tuppence awaiting him.
I've done it, Tommy. I've solved the mystery of the alibi. We can charge up all those half-crowns and 10-shilling notes and demand a substantial fee of our own from Mr. Montgomery Jones, and he can go right off and collect his girl.
What is the solution? Cried Tommy.
A perfectly simple one, said Tuppence.
Twins.
What do you mean, twins?
Why, just that. Of course, it's the only solution.
I will say you put it into my head last night, talking about mothers-in-law, twins, and bottles of beer. I cabled to Australia and got back the information I wanted. Una has a twin sister, Vera, who arrived in England last Monday. That is why she was able to make this bet so spontaneously. She thought it would be a frightful rag on poor Montgomery Jones. The sister went to Torquay, and she stayed in London.
Do you think she'll be terribly despondent that she's lost? Asked Tommy.
No, said Tuppence, I don't. I gave you my views about that before. She will put all the kudos down to Montgomery Jones. I always think respect for your husband's abilities should be the foundation of married life.
I'm glad to have inspired these sentiments in you, Tuppence.
It is not a really satisfactory solution, said Tuppence. Not the ingenious sort of flaw that Inspector French would have detected.
Oh, nonsense, said Tommy. I think the way I showed these photographs to the waiter in the restaurant was exactly like Inspector French.
He didn't have to use nearly so many half-crowns and 10-shilling notes as we seem to have done, said Tuppence.
Well, never mind, said Tommy. We can charge them all up, with additions, to Mr. Montgomery Jones. He will be in such a state of idiotic bliss that he would probably pay the most enormous bill without jibbing at it.
So he should, said Tuppence. Haven't Blunt's brilliant detectives been brilliantly successful? Oh, Tommy, I do think we're extraordinarily clever. It quite frightens me sometimes.
The next case we have shall be a Roger Sheringham case, and you, Tuppence, shall be Roger Sheringham.
I shall have to talk a lot, said Tuppence.
You do that naturally, said Tommy.
And now, I suggest that we carry out my programme of last night and seek out a music hall where they have plenty of jokes about mothers-in-law, bottles of beer, and twins.
Chapter 14. The Clergyman's Daughter.
I wish, said Tuppence, roaming moodily round the office, that we could befriend a clergyman's daughter.
Why? Asked Tommy.
Well, you may have forgotten the fact, but I was once a clergyman's daughter myself. I remember what it was like, hence this altruistic urge, this spirit of thoughtful consideration for others, this...
You're getting ready to be Roger Sheringham, I see, said Tommy. If you'll allow me to make a criticism, you talk quite as much as he does, but not nearly so well.
On the contrary, said Tuppence, there is a feminine subtlety about my conversation, a je ne sais quoi, that no gross male could ever attain to. I have, moreover, powers unknown to my prototype.
Do I mean prototype?
Words are such uncertain things. They so often sound well, but mean the opposite of what one thinks they do.
Go on, said Tommy kindly.
I was. I was only pausing to take breath. Touching these powers, it is my wish today to assist a clergyman's daughter. You will see, Tommy. The first person to enlist the aid of Blunt's brilliant detectives will be a clergyman's daughter.
I'll bet you it isn't, said Tommy.
Done, said Tuppence.
Hist! To your typewriters, O Israel, one comes.
Mr. Blunt's office was humming with industry as Albert opened the door and announced,
Miss Monica Dean.
A slender, brown-haired girl, rather shabbily dressed, entered and stood hesitating. Tommy came forward.
A good morning, Miss Dean. Won't you sit down and tell us what we can do for you? By the way, let me introduce my confidential secretary, Miss Sheringham.
I'm delighted to make your acquaintance, Miss Dean, said Tuppence.
Your father was in the church, I think.
Yes, he was.
But how did you know that?
Oh, we have our methods, said Tuppence. You mustn't mind me rattling on. Mr. Blunt likes to hear me talk. He always says it gives him ideas.
The girl stared at her. She was a slender creature, not beautiful, but possessing a wistful prettiness. She had a quantity of soft, mouse-coloured hair, and her eyes were dark blue and very lovely, though the dark shadows round them spoke of trouble and anxiety.
"Will you tell me your story, Miss Dean?" said Tommy.
The girl turned to him gratefully.
"It's such a long, rambling story," said the girl. "My name is Monica Dean. My father was the rector of Little Hampsley in Suffolk. He died 3 years ago, and my mother and I were left very badly off. I went out as a governess, but my mother became a confirmed invalid, and I had to come home to look after her. We were desperately poor, but one day we received a lawyer's letter telling us that an aunt of my father's had died and had left everything to me. I had often heard of this aunt, who had quarrelled with my father many years ago, and I knew that she was very well off, so it really seemed that our troubles were at an end. But matters did not turn out quite as well as we had hoped. I inherited the house she had lived in, but after paying one or two small legacies, there was no money left. I suppose she must have lost it during the war, or perhaps she had been living on her capital. Still, we had the house, and almost at once we had a chance of selling it at quite an advantageous price. But foolishly, perhaps, I refused the offer. We were in tiny but expensive lodgings, and I thought it would be much nicer to live in the Red House, where my mother could have comfortable rooms and take in paying guests to cover our expenses. I adhered to this plan, notwithstanding a further tempting offer from the gentleman who wanted to buy. We moved in, and I advertised for paying guests. For a time, all went well. We had several answers to our advertisements. My aunt's old servant remained on with us, and she and I between us did the work of the house. And then, these unaccountable things began to happen.
What things?
The queerest things. The whole place seemed bewitched. Pictures fell down. Crockery flew across the room and broke. One morning we came down to find all the furniture moved round. At first we thought someone was playing a practical joke, but we had to give up that explanation. Sometimes, when we were all sitting down to dinner, a terrific crash would be heard overhead. We would go up and find no one there but a piece of furniture thrown violently to the ground.
"A poltergeist," cried Tuppence, much interested.
"Yes, that's what Dr. O'Neill said, though I don't know what it means."
"It's a sort of evil spirit that plays tricks," explained Tuppence, who in reality knew very little about the subject and was not even sure that she had got the word poltergeist right.
"Well, at any rate, the effect was disastrous. Our visitors were frightened to death and left as soon as possible. We got new ones, and they, too, left hurriedly. I was in despair, and to crown it all, our own tiny income ceased suddenly. The company in which it was invested failed."
"You poor dear," said Tuppence sympathetically. "What a time you have had. Did you want Mr. Blunt to investigate this haunting business?"
"Not exactly. You see, 3 days ago, a gentleman called upon us. His name was Dr. O'Neill. He told us that he was a member of the Society for Physical Research, and that he had heard about the curious manifestations that had taken place in our house, and was much interested, so much so that he was prepared to buy it from us and conduct a series of experiments there."
"Well?"
"Of course, at first, I was overcome with joy. It seemed the way out of all our difficulties, but..."
"Yes?
Perhaps you will think me fanciful. Perhaps I am. But, oh, I'm sure I haven't made a mistake. It was the same man."
"What same man?"
"The same man who wanted to buy it before. Oh, I'm sure I'm right."
"But why shouldn't it be?"
"You don't understand. The two men were quite different. Different name and everything. The first man was quite young, a spruce, dark young man of 30-odd. Dr. O'Neill is about 50. He has a grey beard and wears glasses and stoops. But when he talked, I saw a gold tooth on one side of his mouth. It only shows when he laughs. The other man had a tooth in just the same position. And then I looked at his ears. I had noticed the other man's ears, because they were a peculiar shape, with hardly any lobe. Dr. O'Neill's were just the same. Both things couldn't be a coincidence, could they? I thought and thought, and finally I wrote and said I would let him know in a week. I had noticed Mr. Blunt's advertisement some time ago, as a matter of fact, in an old paper that lined one of the kitchen drawers. I cut it out and came up to town. You were quite right, said Tuppence, nodding her head with vigour. This needs looking into.
A very interesting case, Miss Dean, observed Tommy. We shall be pleased to look into this for you. Eh, Miss Sheringham?
Rather, said Tuppence. And we'll get to the bottom of it, too.
I understand, Miss Dean, went on Tommy, that the household consists of you and your mother and a servant. Can you give me any particulars about the servant?
Her name is Crockett. She was with my aunt about 8 or 10 years. She's an elderly woman, not very pleasant in manner, but a good servant. She's inclined to give herself airs, because her sister married out of her station. Crockett has a nephew, whom she is always telling us is quite the gentleman.
Hmm, said Tommy, rather at a loss how to proceed.
Tuppence had been eyeing Monica keenly.
Now she spoke with sudden decision.
I think the best plan would be for Miss Dean to come out and lunch with me. It's just 1 o'clock. I can get full details from her.
Certainly, Miss Sheringham, said Tommy. An excellent plan.
Look here, said Tuppence, when they were comfortably ensconced at a little table in a neighbouring restaurant. I want to know, is there any special reason why you want to find out about all this?
Monica blushed.
Well, you see, out with it, said Tuppence encouragingly. Well, there are 2 men who want to marry me. The usual story, I suppose, 1 rich, 1 poor, and the poor one is the one you like. I don't know how you know all these things, murmured the girl. That's a sort of law of nature, explained Tuppence. It happens to everybody. It happened to me. You see, even if I sell the house, it won't bring us in enough to live on. Gerald is a dear, but he's desperately poor. Though he's a very clever engineer, and if only he had a little capital, his firm would take him into partnership. And the other, Mr. Partridge, is a very good man, I'm sure, and well off, and if I married him, it would be an end to all our troubles, but I know, said Tuppence sympathetically. It isn't the same thing at all. You can go on telling yourself how good and worthy he is, and adding up his qualities as though they were an addition sum, and it all has a simply refrigerating effect.
Monica nodded.
Well, said Tuppence, I think it would be as well if we went down to the neighbourhood and studied matters upon the spot. What is the address? The Red House, Stourton in the Marsh.
Tuppence wrote down the address in her notebook.
I didn't ask you, Monica began, about terms, she ended, blushing a little. Our payments are strictly by results, said Tuppence gravely. If the secret of the Red House is a profitable one, as seems possible from the anxiety displayed to acquire the property, we should expect a small percentage. Otherwise, nothing. Thank you very much, said the girl gratefully. And now, said Tuppence, don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. Let's enjoy lunch and talk of interesting things.
Chapter 15 The Red House.
Well, said Tommy, looking out of the window of the Crown and Anchor, here we are, a toad in the hole, or whatever this blasted village is called.
Let us review the case, said Tuppence.
By all means, said Tommy. To begin with, getting my say in first, I suspect the invalid mother.
Why?
My dear Tuppence, grant that this poltergeist business is all a put-up job, got up in order to persuade the girl to sell the house, someone must have thrown the things about. Now, the girl said everyone was at dinner, but if the mother is a thoroughgoing invalid, she'd be upstairs in her room. If she was an invalid, she could hardly throw furniture about.
Ah,
but she wouldn't be a real invalid. She'd be shamming.
Why?
Oh, well, there you have me, confessed her husband. I was really going on the well-known principle of suspecting the most unlikely person.
You always make fun of everything, said Tuppence severely. There must be something that makes these people so anxious to get hold of the house.
and if you don't care about getting to the bottom of this matter, I do. I like that girl. She's a dear.
Tommy nodded seriously enough. I quite agree, but I can never resist ragging you, Tuppence. Of course, there's something queer about the house, and whatever it is, it's something that's difficult to get at. Otherwise, a mere burglary would do the trick. But to be willing to buy the house means either that you've got to take up the floors, or pull down walls, or else there's a coal mine under the back garden. I don't want it to be a coal mine. Buried treasure is much more romantic. Said Tommy. In that case, I think that I shall pay a visit to the local bank manager, explain that I'm staying here over Christmas and probably buying the Red House, and discuss the question of opening an account. But why? Wait and see.
Tommy returned at the end of half an hour. His eyes were twinkling. We advanced, Tuppence. Our interview proceeded on the lines indicated. I then asked casually whether he had had much gold paid in, as is often the case nowadays in these small country banks, small farmers who hoarded it during the war, you understand. From that we proceeded quite naturally to the extraordinary vagaries of old ladies. I invented an aunt who, on the outbreak of war, drove to the Army and Navy stores in a four-wheeler and returned with 16 hams. He immediately mentioned a client of his own who had insisted on drawing out every penny of money she had in gold as far as possible, and who had also insisted on having her securities, bearer bonds and such things, given into her own custody. I exclaimed on such an act of folly, and he mentioned casually that she was the former owner of the Red House. You see, Tuppence? She drew out all this money, and she hid it somewhere. You remember that Monica Dean mentioned that they were astonished at the small amount of her estate? Yes. She hid it in the Red House, and someone knows about it. I can make a pretty good guess who that someone is, too. Who? What about the faithful Crockett? She would know all about her mistress's peculiarities. And that gold-toothed Dr. O'Neill? The gentlemanly nephew. Of course. That's it. But whereabouts did she hide it? You know more about old ladies than I do, Tuppence. Where do they hide things? Wrapped up in stockings and petticoats under mattresses. Tommy nodded. I expect you're right. All the same, she can't have done that, because it would have been found when her things were turned over. It worries me. You see, an old lady like that can't have taken up floors or dug holes in the garden. All the same, it's there, in the Red House somewhere. Crockett hasn't found it, but she knows it's there, and once they get the house to themselves, she and her precious nephew, they can turn it upside down until they find what they're after. We've got to get ahead of them. Come on, Tuppence, we'll go to the Red House.
Monica Dean received them. To her mother and Crockett, they were represented as would-be purchasers of the Red House, which would account for their being taken all over the house and grounds. Tommy did not tell Monica of the conclusions he had come to, but he asked her various searching questions. Of the garments and personal belongings of the dead woman, some had been given to Crockett, and others sent to various poor families. Everything had been gone through and turned out.
Did your aunt leave any papers?
The desk was full, and there were some in a drawer in her bedroom, but there was nothing of importance amongst them.
Have they been thrown away?
No. My mother is always very loath to throw away old papers. There were some old-fashioned recipes among them, which she intends to go through one day.
Good, said Tommy approvingly.
Then, indicating an old man who was at work upon one of the flower beds in the garden, he asked, Was that old man the gardener here in your aunt's time?
Yes. He used to come in 3 days a week. He lives in the village. Poor old fellow. He's past doing any really useful work. We have him just once a week to keep things tidied up. We can't afford more.
Tommy winked at Tuppence to indicate that she was to keep Monica with her, and he himself stepped across to where the gardener was working. He spoke a few pleasant words to the old man, asked him if he had been there in the old lady's time, and then said casually,
You buried a box for her once, didn't you?
No, sir. I never buried naught for her. What would she want to bury a box for?
Tommy shook his head. He strolled back to the house, frowning. It was to be hoped that a study of the old lady's papers would yield some clue. Otherwise, the problem was a hard one to solve. The house itself was old-fashioned, but not old enough to contain a secret room or passage. Before leaving,
Monica brought them down a big cardboard box tied with string.
"I've collected all the papers," she whispered, "and they're in here. I thought you could take it away with you, and then you'll have plenty of time to go over them. But I'm sure you won't find anything to throw light on the mysterious happenings in this house."
Her words were interrupted by a terrific crash overhead. Tommy ran quickly up the stairs. A jug and a basin in one of the front rooms was lying on the ground, broken to pieces. There was no one in the room. "The ghost, up to its tricks again," he murmured with a grin. He went downstairs again, thoughtfully.
"I wonder, Miss Dean, if I might speak to the maid, Crockett, for a minute." "Oh, certainly. I will ask her to come to you."
Monica went off to the kitchen. She returned with the elderly maid, who had opened the door to them earlier.
"We are thinking of buying this house," said Tommy pleasantly. "And my wife was wondering whether, in that case, you would care to remain on with us."
Crockett's respectable face displayed no emotion of any kind.
"Thank you, sir," she said. I should like to think it over, if I may."
Tommy turned to Monica.
"I'm delighted with the house, Miss Dean. I understand that there is another buyer in the market.
I know what he has offered for the house, and I will willingly give 100 more. And mind you, that is a good price I'm offering."
Monica murmured something noncommittal, and the Beresfords took their leave.
"I was right," said Tommy, as they went down the drive. "Crockett's in it. Did you notice that she was out of breath?
That was from running down the back stairs after smashing the jug and the basin. Sometimes, very likely, she has admitted her nephew secretly, and he's done a little poltergeisting, whatever you call it, whilst she has been innocently with the family. You'll see. Dr. O'Neill will make a further offer before the day is out." True enough. After dinner, a note was brought. It was from Monica. "I have just heard from Dr. O'Neill. He raises his previous offer by £150.
"The nephew must be a man of means," said Tommy thoughtfully. "And I tell you what, Tuppence, the prize he's after must be well worthwhile."
Oh, if only we could find it.
"Well, let's get on with the spade work."
They were sorting through the big box of papers, a wearisome affair, as they were all jumbled up pell-mell without any kind of order or method. Every few minutes they compared notes.
"What's the latest, Tuppence?"
2 old receipted bills, 3 unimportant letters, a recipe for preserving new potatoes, and 1 for making lemon cheesecake. What's yours?"
1 bill, a poem on spring, 2 newspaper cuttings, "Why Women Buy Pearls, a Sound Investment," and "Man with 4 Wives, Extraordinary Story," and a recipe for jugged hare.
"It's heartbreaking," said Tuppence.
They fell to work once more. At last the box was empty. They looked at each other.
"I put this aside," said Tommy, picking up a half sheet of notepaper, "because it struck me as peculiar. But I don't suppose it's got anything to do with what we're looking for.
Let's see it.
Oh. It's one of these funny things. What do they call them? Anagrams. Charades or something."
She read it.
"My first, you put on glowing coal, and into it you put my hole. My second really is the first. My third mislikes the winter blast."
"Hmm," said Tommy critically. "I don't think much of the poet's rhymes."
"I don't see what you find peculiar about it, though," said Tuppence. "Everybody used to have a collection of these sort of things about 50 years ago. You saved them up for winter evenings round the fire. I wasn't referring to the verse. It's the words written below that strike me as peculiar."
"St. Luke 11:9, she read. "It's a text."
"Yes. But doesn't that strike you as odd?
Would an old lady of a religious persuasion write a text just under a charade?"
"It is rather odd," agreed Tuppence thoughtfully. "I presume that you, being a clergyman's daughter, have got your Bible with you?"
"As a matter of fact, I have."
"Aha, you didn't expect that. Wait a sec."
Tuppence ran to her suitcase, extracted a small red volume, and returned to the table. She turned the leaves rapidly.
"Here we are, Luke chapter 11, verse 9. "Oh, Tommy, look!"
Tommy bent over and looked where Tuppence's small finger pointed to a portion of the verse in question.
"Seek, and ye shall find." "That's it," cried Tuppence. "We've got it. Solve the cryptogram, and the treasure is ours, or rather Monica's."
"Well,
Let's get to work on the cryptogram, as you call it. My first, you put on glowing coal. What does that mean, I wonder? Then, my second really is the first. That's pure gibberish.
It's quite simple, really, said Tuppence kindly. It's just a sort of knack. Let me have it.
Tommy surrendered it willingly. Tuppence ensconced herself in an armchair and began muttering to herself with bent brows.
It's quite simple, really, murmured Tommy when half an hour had elapsed.
Don't crow. We're the wrong generation for this. I've a good mind to go back to town tomorrow and call on some old pussy who would probably read it as easy as winking. It's a knack, that's all.
Well, let's have one more try.
But there aren't many things you can put on glowing coal, said Tuppence thoughtfully.
There's water to put it out, or wood, or a kettle.
It must be one syllable, I suppose.
What about wood, then?
You couldn't put anything into wood, though.
There's no one-syllable word instead of water.
But there must be one-syllable things you can put on a fire in the kettle line.
Saucepans? Mused Tuppence.
Frying pans.
Oh, how about pan? Or pot?
What's a word beginning pan or pot that is something you cook?
Pottery? Suggested Tommy.
You bake that in the fire.
Wouldn't that be near enough?
No, the rest of it doesn't fit.
Pancakes?
No.
Oh, bother.
They were interrupted by the little serving maid, who told them that dinner would be ready in a few minutes.
Only Mrs. Lumley, she wanted to know if you like your potatoes fried or boiled in their jackets. She's got some of each.
Oh, boiled in their jackets, said Tuppence promptly.
I love potatoes.
She stopped dead, with her mouth open.
What's the matter, Tuppence? Have you seen a ghost?
Tommy, cried Tuppence. Don't you see? That's it, the word, I mean. Potatoes.
My first, you put on glowing coal, that's pot. And into it, you put my whole. My second really is the first, that's A, the first letter of the alphabet. My third mislikes the wintry blast. Cold toes, of course.
You're right, Tuppence. Very clever of you.
But I'm afraid we've wasted an awful lot of time over nothing. Potatoes don't fit in at all with missing treasure.
Half a sec, though. What did you read out just now when you were going through the box?
Something about a recipe for new potatoes.
I wonder if there's anything in that.
He rummaged hastily through the pile of recipes.
Here it is. To keep new potatoes.
Put the new potatoes into tins and bury them in the garden. Even in the middle of winter, they will taste as though freshly dug.
We've got it, screamed Tuppence. That's it. The treasure is in the garden, buried in a tin.
But I asked the gardener. He said he'd never buried anything.
Yes, I know, but that's because people never really answer what you say. They answer what they think you mean.
He knew he'd never buried anything out of the common.
We'll go tomorrow and ask him where he buried the potatoes.
The following morning was Christmas Eve. By dint of inquiry, they found the old gardener's cottage. Tuppence broached the subject after some minutes' conversation.
I wish one could have new potatoes at Christmas time, she remarked. Wouldn't they be good with turkey?
Do people round here ever bury them in tins?
I've heard that keeps them fresh.
Aye, that they do, declared the old man. Old Miss Dean up at the Red House, she allus had three tins buried every summer, and as often as not forgot to have them dug up again.
In the bed by the house, as a rule, didn't she?
No. Over against the wall, by the fir tree.
Having got the information they wanted, they soon took their leave of the old man, presenting him with 5 shillings as a Christmas box.
And now for Monica, said Tommy. Tommy, you have no sense of the dramatic. Leave it to me, I've got a beautiful plan. Do you think you could manage to beg, borrow, or steal a spade?
Somehow or other, a spade was duly produced, and that night, late, 2 figures might have been seen stealing into the grounds of the Red House. The place indicated by the gardener was easily found, and Tommy set to work. Presently, his spade rang on metal, and a few seconds later he had unearthed a big biscuit tin. It was sealed round with adhesive plaster and firmly fastened down, but Tuppence, by the aid of Tommy's knife, soon managed to open it. Then she gave a groan. The tin was full of potatoes. She poured them out so that the tin was completely empty, but there were no other contents.
Go on digging, Tommy.
It was some time before a second tin rewarded their search. As before, Tuppence unsealed it.
Well?
Demanded Tommy anxiously.
Potatoes again.
Damn, said Tommy,
and set to once more.
The third time is lucky, said Tuppence consolingly.
I believe the whole thing's a mare's nest, said Tommy gloomily.
But he continued to dig. At last a third tin was brought to light.
Potatoes again,
began Tuppence, then stopped.
Oh, Tommy, we've got it. It's only potatoes on top. Look!
She held up a big old-fashioned velvet bag.
Cut along home, cried Tommy. It's icy cold. Take the bag with you. I must shovel back the earth. And may a thousand curses light upon your head, Tuppence, if you open the bag before I come.
I'll play fair. Ouch! I'm frozen.
She beat a speedy retreat. On arrival at the inn, she had not long to wait. Tommy was hard upon her heels, perspiring freely after his digging and the final brisk run.
Now then, said Tommy, the private inquiry agents make good. Open the loot, Mrs. Beresford.
Inside the bag was a package done up in oil silk and a heavy chamois leather bag. They opened the latter first. It was full of gold sovereigns. Tommy counted them. £200. That was all they would let her have, I suppose.
Cut open the package.
Tuppence did so. It was full of closely folded banknotes. Tommy and Tuppence counted them carefully. They amounted to exactly £20,000.
Phew, said Tommy. Isn't it lucky for Monica that we're both rich and honest?
What's that done up in tissue paper? Tuppence unrolled the little parcel and drew out a magnificent string of pearls, exquisitely matched.
I don't know much about these things, said Tommy slowly, but I'm pretty sure that those pearls are worth another £5,000 at least.
Look at the size of them. Now I see why the old lady kept that cutting about pearls being a good investment. She must have realized all her securities and turned them into notes and jewels.
Oh, Tommy, isn't it wonderful? Darling Monica, now she can marry her nice young man and live happily ever afterwards, like me.
That's rather sweet of you, Tuppence. So, you are happy with me?
As a matter of fact, said Tuppence, I am. But I didn't mean to say so. It slipped out.
What with being excited, and Christmas Eve, and one thing and another. If you really love me, said Tommy, will you answer me one question?
I hate these catches, said Tuppence.
But, well, all right.
Then how did you know that Monica was a clergyman's daughter?
Oh, that was just cheating, said Tuppence happily. I opened her letter making an appointment, and a Mr. Dean was my father's curate once, and he had a little girl called Monica, about 4 or 5 years younger than me. So, I put two and two together.
You are a shameless creature, said Tommy.
Hello, there's 12 o'clock striking. Happy Christmas, Tuppence.
Happy Christmas, Tommy.
It'll be a happy Christmas for Monica, too, and all owing to us.
I am glad.
Poor thing. She's been so miserable. You know, Tommy, I feel all queer and choky about the throat when I think of it.
Darling Tuppence, said Tommy.
Darling Tommy, said Tuppence.
How awfully sentimental we are getting.
Christmas comes but once a year, said Tommy sententiously.
That's what our great-grandmother said.
And I expect there's a lot of truth in it still.